This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Emma Barnett and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4. Good morning and welcome to the programme. Here we go again, another week. And if you have an office-based job, are you back in at the office or are you at home or perhaps a bit of both? Over the weekend, in an interview with the Daily Mail headlined "Working from Home Doesn't Work," the Prime Minister had this to say. My experience of working from home is you spend an awful lot of time making another cup of coffee and then, you know, getting up, walking very slowly to the fridge, hacking off a small piece of cheese and then walking very slowly back to your laptop and then forgetting what it was you're doing. Boris Johnson's on a mission to reverse what looks like a permanent mindset shift in the UK, according to data analysis in the Financial Times today. Numbers I'll get into shortly. There was a big response to what the Prime Minister had to say with his take about working from home, with many women in particular talking about their experiences online over the weekend and sharing mainly on social media, but also people writing about their experiences too. I want to give you the opportunity today on the programme to say where you are with this, if it affects you. Of course, this is mainly about office jobs. Whether you have gone back in, whether you haven't, are you doing a bit of both? Have you been forced to go back in as it was before? And perhaps that's made you think differently about whether it's better, whether it's not, what works. Maybe you're not going to stay with the work that you're with. There's some data to show this. If you have been forced to go in full time, there's some information about that in some of the charts today saying that if you have been forced, people will turn away from those jobs. Of course, what Boris Johnson was also talking about is the need to revive city centres, to get commuting back up and help, if you like, give the economy a boost, a shot in the arm, to use some of his words. And I'll give you a few more, if you like, very shortly. Where are you with this? Text me here at Woman's Hour on 84844. Do you think working from home works? On social media, it's at BBC Woman's Hour, or email me through the Woman's Hour website. Also on today's programme, why some women in America are now thinking twice about using period tracking apps. And this weekend, Little Mix said goodbye to their fans with their final show on Saturday before taking a break. Now it seems for the first time in decades, Britain is without a major girl band. What does Mel C, aka Sporty Spice, think about that? We'll find out. And just to say, having written my own article this weekend about my experiences, I suppose, of being a woman at the moment and trying for a second baby, I just wanted to thank the many of you who've been kind enough to be in touch, offering advice and good wishes. I am very grateful, but also to many of you feeling like you could share your experiences too, and not easy to do so. So something I ask you to do every day here on this programme, and I'm always grateful when you do. So let's get on with it. And today it is about where and how you might be working, because according to data in the Financial Times paper today, commuter numbers are still almost a quarter down on levels seen in February 2020 before coronavirus and lockdown restrictions. This makes the UK an outlier amongst most other advanced economies, with Germany only 7% below pre-pandemic commuter numbers, to do a comparison. Findings from last year from the think tank, the Resolution Foundation, found that 500,000 women increased their working hours from part-time to full-time during the pandemic as they were able to work remotely. And as I mentioned, this week the Prime Minister has continued the push from certain members of government to return to the office. But tell us how it is for you. Do get in touch. I really want to hear how it is for you at the moment. Already some of you doing that. I'll come to those messages shortly. But to analyse these figures more, Dr. Jane Parry joins me now, Associate Professor of Work and Employment at Southampton Business School, and The Guardian columnist Gabby Hinsliff. Gabby, I'll come to you in just a moment, but Dr. Jane Parry, good morning.
Good morning.
What do we know about the latest figures?
Well, we know that over a third of people are still working from home, at least sometimes. I mean, the centre of the discussion now is shifting away from working at home all the time to the hybrid forms of working. So what combination of working in offices versus home works best for different kinds of jobs?
And in terms of, I suppose, the reason for that, is that being business-led? Is that employee-led? What do we know about that?
Well, the organisations that we spoke to in our research, Work After Lockdown, it was trying to get that balance between the employer and the employee right, because that's what needs to happen to make it successful, because there's been this huge building of goodwill and trust during the pandemic, which is a huge asset for businesses. So they want to carry that with them in the next step and not alienate their staff, like some of the kind of more authoritarian messages about everyone get back to the office without kind of engaging in the nuance of what works best.
Gabby, let me bring you in at this point. I introduced you as a columnist, but of course a political reporter for many years as well. What do you make of the politics of this?
It's slightly mad, I think. I mean, the Prime Minister feels very out of touch with what the reality of working life is now. You've got him saying, oh, everyone back to the office. And very clearly, the trend is the other way. People's desire is the other way, where they can change their way of working. They want to. They absolutely see the advantage of that. And you have the Prime Minister and Jacob Rees-Mogg, you know, very stubbornly digging into this everyone back thing, which I think is partly driven by a sense of, you know, who are the economic casualties if we don't go back to work? You know, if you're if you work in presse-manger or if you work for a commuter train company, you probably have a very different feeling about that than if you're going to benefit from working home. But although I think it's partly that thing, a lot of us have probably heard over the years from middle-aged male managers who just don't accept, if I can't see you in front of me, how do I know you're working? You know, there's this old, very old kind of lazy assumption that if you're working from home, you're not really working, you're really skiving. But to have the Prime Minister articulating that, I think is incredibly undermining for a lot of, you know, millions of women who work really hard and well from home and are more productive, you know, when they work flexibly. It's kind of mad to have the Prime Minister repeating this kind of very lazy old trope about what working from home is.
There's that element, there's definitely that reaction, and that has been definitely commented on by a lot of women, and I've certainly seen those sorts of responses across social media this weekend. But he claims it will lift productivity to be back together, revive town and city centres, and that he thinks staff will be more productive, more energetic and more full of ideas. And while we have a lot of messages that I will come to about the benefits that you're talking about, Gabby, coming in from our listeners, I do just see a message that's come in saying that they feel very lonely and isolated, and I would look for another job, but I'll have to take a large pay cut if I do, reads this message. It's harming my mental health and I don't see a way out. What do you say about what the Prime Minister is trying to say, I suppose, about improved working and creativity?
Well, the evidence on productivity is actually the other way. There's now a mountain of evidence suggesting that that companies that introduce flexible working increase their productivity. I think, I mean, I know what you mean as someone who's worked from home a lot for years. I know what you mean about, you know, feeling lonely and isolated. If all you're doing is staring at your spare bedroom wall for, you know, all day long, stuck in the house, that's pretty demotivating. But I think it's always about, I think Jane was right, you know, most people are going to want a hybrid. They're going to want to be in some of the time, not in some of the time. It's about working out where you do the different bits of your job best. For people who are being forced into working from home, when they don't want to, that's no better than being forced to come into the office when you don't want to. And I think the sort of missing piece of the jigsaw, perhaps, for people who are working constantly from home is the setting. There's been a lot of investment in some places in setting up what's called co-working hubs, which are like remote offices where lots of people who, you know, you can individually rent desk space and be around other people even when you're not in an office atmosphere. Because we all do need people to bounce ideas off sometimes and just, you know, get a bit of socialisation into your day.
Yes, and the other thing you've been looking at, and I've been reading your article this morning, looking at some of the numbers, but also what's happening, is that outside of London and the major city centres, this actually is helping people.
Well, this is the flip side of, you know, yes, you know, the centre of London might be a bit emptier if more people are working from home. But that, you know, that tends to re-energise and reinvigorate the places where people are actually living, you know, local high streets, the suburbs, towns outside London, outlying London. What I was looking at is the possibility for red wall areas, places like Stoke, which is massively invested in, you know, this kind of whole idea of high tech, work from home, remote working. Would you have to, if you don't have to leave your hometown to get a decent job in a city, if you can do that job from where you are, you know, that's potentially a lifeline for those, for those kind of towns that have felt, you know, have suffered for years from bright kids moving away to get better jobs. So there's always winners and there's always losers. And of course, in any economic change, you know, it's really tough on the losers. But it'd be better if government sort of engaged in this argument and tried to, you know, find ways of reshaping what's happening for the public good, rather than just standing on the sidelines shouting everyone back to the office, when that's clearly not what either business wants at the moment or what
Although you have also found, Gabby, some insights and evidence that there's not just shouting from the sidelines. There is engagement with this, with different parts of government looking at this.
That's what's frustrating. I think there are parts of government that very clearly recognise, you know, the benefits potentially of home. A lot of very frustrated Tory MPs who would like to see the government move faster on flexible working, you know, a lot of parts of government concerned with regeneration, a lot of serious work being done behind the scenes on how the world of work is changing. But the public message people hear is this stuff about how if you work from home, all you do is traipse to the fridge and back, which I think says more about Boris Johnson and his approach to working from home than it does to most people's approach from working from home. Well, it doesn't suit everybody.
There is a message here from PJ saying, I'm a writer, I work from home, I have a fridge. I also have self-discipline. Perhaps the Prime Minister should acquire some. But there's another one here saying this narrative is absurd. Those working at home, or some or all of the time, are hopefully putting more money into their local businesses and supporting a better high street. This, doing this should be applauded, not vilified. So talking about the local area and, if you like, the town centre that's closest to you, with a smaller T, as it were. Jane, to bring you back into this, Dr. Jane Parry, I mentioned there that if you're being forced to go back in full time, people are then going to look to change jobs. That's what some of the data is showing, I believe. You tell us a bit more, but also, do you think this mindset shift is permanent?
Yeah, it definitely is permanent, because employers have had the one thing they've never had before, which is a whole set of evidence that it has worked for most office-based jobs, and you can now organise work in a way that you can do that kind of productive report writing in a much more efficient way. I think the law firms that we spoke to in particular were getting quite worried about this mass resignation, and this is one of the first things that gets talked about in interviews now. What are your flexible working arrangements? So organisations are having to respond to this, and the winners and losers will kind of sort themselves out naturally. I think another important point to make about this is the inequalities around it that are being raised. So, for example, you mentioned about women who've been able to shift to do full-time contracts because they're able to do this with flexible work. Older women, there's a third, a half a million older workers have left the workforce because they haven't been able to work their work around care. So these are very real productivity losses that we will see, and also people with limited long-term illnesses, much more likely to be able to work when they're working from home. And it's just sad if these productivity issues will get boiled down to eating cheese, when actually we have this huge opportunity to make work more inclusive and more productive. It's a win-win for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, if I could, I don't do a job where you can eat live. But you know, you could also be incredibly productive, Gabby, while eating a bit of cheese. I think that someone's been at pains to point that out as well on the message. There's a message from Matt here who says, I run a recruitment company. I've experienced the change in attitudes of both employers and employees on a daily basis. Now all employees ask what the hybrid working policies of potential new employers are, and will almost without exception decline rhymes with no flexible working policy. The genie is out of the bottle and it cannot be put back in. And let me put this one to you, Gabby, specifically about women. Many messages along these lines. This is from Sharon. Yes, working from home means I can drop the children at school, work all morning and a half day and collect them again. If I had to commute into the office, I would either do fewer hours or I'd have to pay for childcare, and this way suits our family better and I get the satisfaction of work. And there are more along those lines. Do you think there's something specific about the two highest profile individuals, I suppose, from the cabinet, Jacob Rees-Mogg and Boris Johnson, of course, both being men in this respect and talking about this in this particular way?
I think there is. I mean, I think it's interesting because working from home is the one part of the sort of flexible working armory that's always appealed more to men than women, interestingly. I remember years, a decade ago, when I was doing the research for my book, Half a Wife, that was what interested me in it because it was the one that men went for. And why did they go for it? Because it's the only one for which you don't take a pay cut. It's not like going part-time. Mm. You know, you can go to a day from working from home and you've not lost any money. In fact, you've probably gained some because you've saved money on a commute. So, you know, it does... Naturally, it was the one that men went for, but the one that women now absolutely see the value of. I'd also say, actually, it's not just about, we're talking a lot about parents for obvious reasons, but I was really struck last year. I was writing a piece about women with extreme menopausal symptoms, and I was really struck by how many of them said lockdown was a godsend because it meant that I could work from home and I could manage, you know, I wasn't having to cope with hot flushes or heavy bleeding or something in front of a room full of nosy colleagues. You know, you could just, and it steered those women through jobs that they might otherwise have had to give up. And that really struck me because we don't think about flexible working in those terms, and it might be a reason that people are embarrassed to ask for flexible working. But once a company just has a this is the hybrid policy for everyone, you don't have to say why, you can do 2 days a week from home if you want to, you don't have to explain yourself, that makes it so much easier, I think, for lots of people to take advantage of it who couldn't before. And I wouldn't, you know, necessarily expect Jacob Rees-Mogg instantly to leap to that understanding of working from home, maybe, but it's really important.
Well, I'd be very open to having Mr. Rees-Mogg or Mr. Johnson, of course, on this programme. Invitations have been issued and will be issued again. Gabby Hinsliff, thank you very much for your time and analysis. And Dr. Jane Parry, the same to you. A message here, nothing to do with how it feels or anything to do with caring duties. It's actually about productivity with regards to working from home. I think the productivity argument is true for some, but I am finding it more productive at home when I can take short breaks without feeling pressure to look busy and also know I can switch off at the end of the day without facing a 45-minute commute. I think employers should have more trust in employees to decide what works for them. And working from home has reduced the time I am off because of fibroids and menopause symptoms. This message from Victoria, just as we were talking about, it's also incredibly helpful that as a single parent for the reasons mentioned by others. Keep your messages coming in and your experiences too on 84844. That's the number you need to send me a message here, or on social media, we're at BBC Woman's Hour. Now let me ask you a completely different question, but you can keep answering that one. Who was your favourite girl band? I am asking because this weekend, the hugely successful Little Mix said goodbye to their fans with their final show on Saturday before taking a break, we're told. Now it seems for the first time in decades, Britain is without a major girl band. Does that matter? What does it say about us, about society, if anything? Well, I really want to know what Melanie Chisholm, or Mel C, as most of you know her, Sporty Spice from the Spice Girls, of course, thinks about all of this, as well as, of course, the music journalist and curator, Jacqueline Springer. Warm welcome to you both. But Mel C, good morning to you first.
Good morning.
How are you today?
I'm good. It's been a busy few days. I was very excited to see the FA Cup on Saturday, my team Liverpool winning, which was glorious. And of course, Eurovision. And I've been working throughout as well. So yeah, a great weekend.
Well, yes. And of course, for some, it's the last time they're going to see Little Mix, which is what we're having our conversation about. And I wonder, having been a member of the great British girl band for so many, what you make of the fact that there isn't going to be one now, a major one at the moment. What do you think of that?
Well, I think, first of all, to talk about Little Mix, what an incredible band. And they've done something quite remarkable because, obviously, being a part of the Spice Girls, so proud of what we achieved and the legacy that we've left behind. But we really weren't together for very long in that first phase of the Spice Girls. Little Mix have been around for over a decade. And I think for any pop band, female, male, you know, mixed gender, it's hard. You know, the schedule is tough. It's hard to maintain that success, that level of workload, and they've done an incredible job. So I'm a huge fan. My daughter's 13, so she's really grown up with them, and she was very sad to see this little pause in the Little Mix proceedings. And I think it's a shame, you know, it's a real shame, but the music industry is looking quite different right now. The landscape is different. There's not really a boy band out there at the moment either, you know, so these things are changing. And the thing I hope for the girls from Little Mix is that they get a fair crack of the whip as solo artists. Because I think as a woman, that's where it changes. You know, we have girl bands that have success, but to go on as a solo artist as a female seems to be a lot harder for the girls as it has been for the boys.
Oh, why do you think that is?
I think it's for all of those reasons that the Spice Girls first started speaking about girl power, because we were told girl bands don't sell. It's young girls that buy records. Of course, now it's all about streaming. We consume music so differently. But I think when you're out there, as any member who's been in a band going solo, it's tough. But I think for those reasons, the boys do tend to fare better. I think there's, you know, obviously there's a whole ageism situation that some of us more mature artists find in pop music. But some of the boys will get played on certain radio stations where the girls don't get a look in when they reach a certain age. So that's another little discussion we should have at some point.
We should. You sound like you're in the know about that. And I also wonder for you, I mean, do you think we may have grown out of girl bands in some way? Because, listen, I'm going to, full disclosure, part of my weekend was organising my sister-in-law's hen do, which did involve a large pink party bus, to my shame and pride. And we did play out Spice Girls at one point, and it was a great moment. I didn't actually know we were going to be talking today. And we all just came together and we were singing. And it's such... It takes you back straight away to where you were at that particular moment in your life. But also, you just feel connected to the women singing. And I feel like every generation kind of needs that. But maybe it's not right anymore. I don't know. What do you think?
You know, I think with music, like with so many things, with fashion, you know, we go in cycles, don't we? And the world is so different now. You know, I'm trying to view it through my daughter's eyes, which is, you know, it's so different. We're not really the demographic, are we? We're not looking out there for the next pop band. But I think you're right. You know, doing the shows with the Spice Girls 2019, we were lucky enough to do a stadium tour here in the UK and Ireland. And it felt like a golden age to be a Spice Girl, because so many of our original fans from the 90s now were able to come back. It felt very nostalgic. It felt very inclusive. And I agree, we all need those moments for the future to be able to come together and kind of relive those simpler times of growing up.
Jacqueline, let me bring you in at this point. What do you think the gap's all about? Is it about cycles? There'll be another one, or are we changing? And we perhaps in the era of social media, we can't kind of accept people being put together for the purposes of music.
I don't think it's about whether a group comes together organically or are put together. It does come down to timing. It comes down to their look. It comes down to, you know, the quality of the production. It comes down to whether or not what they're saying actually hits your heart, hits your mind. You know, there's so many elements that there's a really therapeutic relationship we have with groups when we are maturing, and they allow us to have a conversation, even though it's one-sided seemingly,
yes,
whereby they understand things. So when your parents are resisting the idea that you're maturing, that you have crushes, that you want to stay out, that you want your own money, you have these groups creating these anthems. And this goes all the way back, you know, back to the 50s, you know, remember it was a male group, you know, that song Get a Job, where they were actually mocking the parents' demands for chores to be met before you could actually go off and just be who you want to be. And I think in answer to your question, one thing that I think is really important, I absolutely understand that we're talking about pop groups here, but there are single sex groups of every musical genre already out there. And the idea of being pop is not necessarily the objective. Being wealthy and being good and being popular to your peers, to your demographic, is. And so it's very interesting to consider what constitutes a major pop group, because depending, just like you're saying, in terms of your age demographic, your favorite group is your group, and you take them on throughout the rest of your life.
And you have a bond with them, and also you, of course, go towards those who you feel represent something for you in your life.
Yeah, you
and
have
how
rows
you are
with people about who's the most important, who's the prettiest, you know, and all of these things spill out. But I also think that, just as Melanie said, the landscape, the media platform landscape is very different. There's a group called Flow who work with collaborators that Little Mix have worked with, like MNEK and others. And they're bubbling up on a number of different platforms, on TikTok, as well as, you know, having a really sly and nonchalant couple of seconds promo on Instagram before they even hit the screen. And so,
well, I was also thinking about, I don't know, I was thinking about Eternal this morning. I was thinking about All Saints. I was thinking about these different moments in, you know, my life that I could think about women and what they were saying through pop music. And I take the point, it's about, we're talking about that particular genre. Do you think, just picking up a little bit of what Melanie was saying there, do you think girl bands are treated as seriously as other music artists? Is there a difference in how they're viewed, and perhaps there's still that concern they won't be as commercially successful?
Well, I think the whole vernacular of how we actually relate to artists needs a good bleaching, because you know, they're called bands and boy bands, and many of them don't play instruments. They're called girl groups. These are women invariably, and so we have this idea where everybody's infantilized, or their abilities are either minimized or suggestive of greater skill. And the very idea that you don't make the kind of music you did when you were in a group, of course not, because it's you. When Melanie collaborated with Lisa Left Eye from TLC, nobody expected that. When Mel B collaborated with Missy Elliott, nobody expected that. And so what you have with Little Mix, they had collaborated with Missy Elliott, with Nicki Minaj and others. These are things where you can actually speak up and say, do you know what? For the group think, group objective, that's that. For me, I want to do X, Y, and Z. And whether or not, and then we also have the idea that, the fact that people age and people want to have families, and people may not want to have families. People don't want to do the record, tour schedule, which is deeply damaging for the mental health as well. And then our expectations as we grow, why aren't they making music for us? And so, in answer to your question, no, women are not treated the same way as they when they emerge from their group ranks. And but then you do have these surprises with boy band members as well.
Yeah, no, well, of course, and how they then move on. Melanie, to come back to you on that point, I think the other thing is that we don't like our, you know, and I'm speaking collectively here, of course, I'm generalising as well, but typically we don't like our girl bands, and as Jacqueline says, women, actually, to age. And we want them to stay the way they are. And then there's a lot of upset if there are changes, because people do get fixed. Did you ever find that suffocating or difficult?
I think it's kind of become like the new little mission, you know, post the girl power era. Obviously, I still love making music. I still tour. I'm still active in that world. But you do find, you know, there's new barriers being put up at every turn. So that's, you know, but I feel like, you know, generally for women, we're coming into this time where, you know, middle-aged women, which is, you know, what I suppose I have to admit I am these days, is I feel like it's our time. You know, we're speaking up now and we've got something to say. And I still love music. I love pop music. I love very young artists. I love older artists. And I feel like there has to be an audience who want to hear what a more mature female pop artist has to say, you know? So I think we have to kind of change the thinking behind that.
But I suppose when people come up to you in the street, and I'm sure they still do, is it frustrating, or do you embrace it, the whole Sporty Spice thing, and they still want to kind of bring up, you know, you when you're in your 20s?
Absolutely. I completely embrace it now. I went through many years of not. I've had a journey with this whole thing. But I think, you know, going back to 2019 again, being back on stage with the girls, it gave us an opportunity to really appreciate everything that we'd achieved. And it gave me this moment to go, wow, I'm not either a Spice Girl or a solo artist or a mum. I'm all of these things all of the time. And that was like a light bulb moment for me. And yeah, I completely embrace it. And I'm so proud to be a Spice Girl. And when people call me former Spice Girl, I get a little bit cross, because I think once you're a Spice Girl, you're always a Spice Girl. So yeah, I'm very, very proud and always happy to see people out and about celebrating that.
Well, yeah, I'm happy you didn't see me on Saturday. Let's just put it like that.
I wish I was there.
It's quite messy. But I heard your voice. Melanie Chisholm, thank you so much for talking to us this morning. And good luck with all of your solo endeavours and everything else as well. And Jacqueline Springer, always brilliant to get your take on things. Thank you to you. Some messages, of course, coming in about music and girl bands and what they mean to you, if you've even called them that. I'll come to those very shortly. And also messages coming in about working from home. When my husband works from home, he is far more productive, reads this email, and it means I've been able to start working again part-time because he can do more with childcare. I work in schools, so no flexibility. Now he's having to go back into the office more. This means he's less productive and therefore gets more stressed. It also puts more pressure on me as I'm having to take on the extra childcare and work. I feel for us, we're taking a step back in terms of gender equality. Those remarks, of course, off the back of what the Prime Minister has been talking about over the weekend, under a headline saying working from home doesn't work. Jane says, I work front of house at a museum. It feels that staff that now work from home have lost social skills and have less and less connection to the museum itself. Team spirit is down and it feels like there is a hierarchy amongst the team. Very interesting perspective from Jane there. Thank you very much. Good morning to you. Well, let's cross to the pond now, or cross the pond, I should say, rather, to the United States, where women have been raising concerns about period and pregnancy tracking apps on their phones over concerns their data could potentially be stored, shared and later used against them should they ever seek to have an abortion. It follows fears that the US Supreme Court is about to overturn the landmark Roe v. Wade case, which guarantees a woman's constitutional right to abortion nationwide. If overturned, as we've been discussing, the US would move to a system of allowing individual states to decide whether to allow abortion, ban it, or heavily restrict it. So how careful do women need to be with their cycle data who are concerned about that potential overturn as opposed to those who are hoping it will happen? Well, in a moment, I will talk to Gillian York, who's from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, an American digital rights group. She joins me from Berlin. But first, let me talk to the BBC's technology reporter, Shona McCallum, for a bit of background on this. Shona, good morning.
Hiya.
Tell us just about what these apps are, first of all.
Yes, so period trackers log dates, they calculate your average of your menstrual cycle and they predict then when you're going to start your next period. Women put the data in, you know, when you started your period, symptoms like logging flow, how bad cramps are, and basically then the algorithm feeds you when your period is due. People might use them to be just aware of how their body's doing, understand their reactions to various parts of the cycle, be prepared for your next period, to track ovulation and potentially get pregnant. It also informs conversations with medical professionals if you have something like endometriosis, and also to track the perimenopause. So we know, obviously, periods typically occur once a month, but you know, with exact timing, flow, symptoms, etc., period tracker apps can be really useful for women.
And, you know, a lot of them use them here, of course, in the UK as well. But there's a particular element of concern that's being discussed in America at the moment with regards to that leak I mentioned from the Supreme Court. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so quite bluntly, women are worried that their menstrual cycle data could be used against them by law enforcement if the individual states uphold those state laws. So they bring lawsuits and investigations onto people who are having abortions, then they may look into this data. You know, they may have a look at the data that women are putting in, because we know that there has been leaks to the big data companies. Obviously, when it comes to an abortion, you know, people turn to tech. You may Google abortion, what's involved, where to go, is it legal, those kind of things. And you'll also be inputting that information if you're using a period tracker. And so the worry is, yeah, law enforcement will take a keen interest in this data and could reveal, you know, what intentions women have and ultimately get them into trouble.
Let me bring in Gillian at this point, as I say, from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, an American digital rights group. Good morning. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
How concerned are you about these apps and women's reproductive data?
Yeah, so we're absolutely concerned about these apps. But I think it's really important to note that our concerns about data privacy are far from limited to period trackers. So the way that I look at it is, it's about all of the different data that you're using. So it's period trackers, but it's also things like your location data, the phone calls that you make, your text messages, et cetera. So there was a case about 2 years ago that I just want to mention, where a mother of three in the United States, in Mississippi, where a lot of this battle has been ongoing for a few years, was charged after having a stillborn birth. And part of the charge that happened there was actually about her internet search results. She'd been searching for ways to induce a miscarriage, searching for things like buying misoprostol abortion pills online. And that, combined with some questionable medical evidence done by the state medical examiner, allowed the state to convict her a grand jury rather, to indict her on a charge of second degree murder for using all of that data that was combined. So it is the period tracker apps, but it's also a number of other things as well.
And those charges were dropped in the end with that particular case.
Yes.
But the point I suppose you're saying is what can be used when a case is being built. And we don't yet know, of course, how this is going to play out with regards to abortion law in America at the moment. Do you think that women are therefore, just because we are talking specifically about this, are right to be perhaps pulling back from sharing such information? Because, of course, there's also been a lot made about femtech, as it's called by some, and the benefits of course, being able to monitor those things. In fact, there was criticism of Apple when they launched their health suite that they didn't include, for instance, a period tracker.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think women are absolutely right to be concerned. We've seen research from groups like Privacy International in the UK that have shown that these apps are collecting a really large amount of data and storing that data for lengthy periods of time, perhaps unnecessarily so. I absolutely recognize how useful these apps can be, and I understand why people want to use them. Really see it on being on these companies to limit the way that they retain data and the data that they capture in the first place. But I also, it's hard to say women just stop using these apps, turn back to, writing things in your diary, even though that may be a safer alternative. It's really important that we look towards holding the apps accountable.
Well, we did, of course, contact some of the most popular period tracking apps to see if anyone could come and talk to us. We emailed Flow, Period Tracker, Eve by Glow, My Calendar, Period Tracker, and Clue. Clue, which has 12 million users in over 190 countries, did actually come back to us with a statement saying, "We completely understand this anxiety. We want to reassure you that your health data, particularly any data you track in Clue about pregnancies, pregnancy loss, or abortion, is kept private and safe. Keeping Clue users' sensitive data safe is fundamental to our mission of self-empowerment and fundamental to our business model too, because that depends on earning our community's trust." I just bring in Shona again for a moment here, because last year the Federal Trade Commission found that the Flow app had been sharing data from its period ovulation app with marketing analytics companies and Facebook. Tell us a bit more about that, because of course when data is then shared, how is it used, women's data?
Yes, so the FTC found that Flow had informed Facebook of in-app activity. So that's when a user is having your period or informed it of an intention to get pregnant. Not to get too technical, but that's done something through a bit of software development kit. It's an SDK. It's often incorporated into apps and it basically uses third parties. So that's why the information that women were inputting got into the likes of Facebook. So basically, they're using that information to deliver targeted online advertising and looking at the data, looking at whether or not marketing campaigns had an effect, what conversations women were having online, what were the consumer behaviour, regional preferences, blah, blah. They said that they didn't give date of birth and they didn't give, that type of personal information. They were only looking at the data as a whole. However, you can imagine the outcry when women find that, okay, my health information could potentially be with Facebook and Google. It's deeply personal, this information, isn't it? And then when you look onto the apps, you do see that some of them will share with third parties.
Yes, and I think that's the other thing, just to give you the final word, Gillian, is how personal the nature of this data is. And I know what you're saying about other apps and other pieces of information, but this feels particularly personal and personal to women.
Absolutely. It's very personal data. And I think women have a right to be concerned. There's a lot of things that they can do to work to protect their digital rights around this. There's a lot of great tips out there. At this moment, I think it's really important for us to look towards holding these companies accountable about the way that they store data.
Yeah, and also just to say there's the hope, of course, by sharing, which some have said in these businesses, that they can contribute towards understanding medical research. In fact, they would grant access on that basis because they want more information about, conditions, for instance, that there isn't enough research on. But at the same time, I suppose you really have to make sure you've consented, check all your settings and make sure you've read the small print, which I suppose I'm sure you see this all the time, Shona, as a technology reporter. People just click through, don't really read and say accept. Gillian, thank you very much to you, Gillian York from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and to the BBC technology reporter, Shona McCallum. Now, in the wake of the killings that we have reported on, the tragic killings of toddlers Star Hobson and Arthur Lembinjo Hughes, we are awaiting a government report to be published shortly looking into what went wrong with those cases. Social workers, you may recall, had failed to act on warnings from relatives, which meant the children were not removed from their abusive homes. Tonight, though, a BBC One panorama explores a different perspective, which we wanted to bring you early sight of today. What about when children's services intervene too far, too fast, and when they act unethically, even unlawfully, towards children and their parents, causing lifelong trauma in the process? Well, one local authority, Herefordshire Council, has been severely and repeatedly criticised by a High Court judge for breaching children's human rights through what the judge called appalling social work practice. Panorama reporter Louise Tickle is here to tell us some more. Louise, your investigation into this council's taken more than a year. I know that you had to go to court a number of times to get permission to talk to the families. Perhaps we could start by you explaining why that was.
Whenever parents end up in the family court, proceedings are held in private in order to protect the children's privacy. But that can mean however badly children's services behave towards a family, and there are some truly shocking examples in our film tonight, the law is that they're not allowed to tell anyone, not their friends, not a journalist, about the details of what's been revealed in court. So in the four Herefordshire cases that I was initially investigating, the judge, Mr. Justice Kean, he'd published very detailed anonymised judgments explaining how children and families had been harmed by poor social work practice right from the top to the bottom of Herefordshire Children's Services Department. And when you read that as a journalist, you want to hear from the people involved. So I had to make an application to the judge for anyone who consented to be able to talk to me free of the threat of being held in contempt of court. I also had to ask for permission to be able to publish what they said and using their names and pictures if they agreed. Herefordshire Council, well, they fought aspects of my application, but ultimately the judge upheld the right of the media to tell these stories because of the public interest in doing so.
And what did the families tell you?
Well, first of all, I had to find them. Mm. I didn't have any names or any addresses, so I had to ask all the families' lawyers to send letters of introduction to their former clients. Then the judge even had to order Herefordshire Council to send my letters to two family members who I couldn't locate. And when I was then phoned up by sisters who'd been treated appallingly while in care and met the adoptive parents of twins who had been unlawfully separated for adoption, it's a very, very different thing to reading a judgment, because meeting them, you see and you hear the human impact of poor social work practice, and you understand in a very visceral way how children can be damaged.
Oh, bet. I mean, how would you describe how they've been affected? I know you go into this tonight, but what would you say?
Well, one young woman who we've called Gemma in the film feels incredibly let down that she lost her chance to be adopted thanks to Herefordshire Council inexplicably going against a court order that she and her sister should have the chance of a family they could call her own. And seeing her sadness at losing her relationship with the foster mother who had wanted to adopt her, and then being moved hundreds of miles from her and her sister, who she never lived with again. It was pretty heartbreaking. She's got her own children now, and she's such an impressive mum. But for herself, she told me that she feels very alone and just lonely in the world. And you know, the adoptive parents of twins who were unlawfully separated by Herefordshire Council have been, I would say, in their different ways, traumatised by the way the twins and they were treated by social workers. They're angry and they're baffled, and they went through hell over months spent in court. They've lost their trust in social workers to tell the truth and work in the best interests of children. And that's hardly surprising, given that they discovered in court that an expert's recommendation that the twins should be adopted together had been deliberately altered, changing its meaning completely, so they were placed for adoption separately. And the human anguish caused by this kind of unethical practice has appalled them. It appalled the judge, and the implications of it are destructive, and they are lifelong.
Yes, well, I mean, they are important cases to hear the details of. They were cases from a few years ago, but I understand you've also interviewed families who are currently being investigated by Children's Services, Herefordshire Children's Services.
Right. Yeah, we had to go to court again to be able to interview a mother called Angeline and fight for the right for her to speak in her own name and voice about how she feels she and her children have been treated by social workers. She was being investigated by social workers amid accusations that she was harming her children by inventing or exaggerating illnesses and taking them to the doctors too often. But she told me that even when she presented social workers with evidence about her children, she felt they didn't believe her. No findings have been made against her, and her children remain with her, although the family is still being monitored by social workers.
Well, you actually put us in touch with Angeline. I was able to speak to her before the programme and ask her the effect that this had had on her.
Huge effect. It's left. They say about, I admitted being over anxious. I was anxious, as any parent is, if your child isn't very well or anything. And I always felt judged because at the time we obviously had the LA involvement. So that's where the anxiety came from, which is why I admitted to it, because I was anxious. It's probably heightened my anxiety. It caused me to lose friends, family, work. At times, I remember putting my children to bed and looking at them and thinking the worst thing for them would be to be ripped out of my arms. And I remember just feeling, to stop their pain, I need to take my own life. They need to be protected. And it wasn't because I didn't love them. I got to that point where I was just fighting a brick wall. There was no support. They were making life harder instead of better.
Angeline talking to me before I came on air. That's one family, of course, being affected by this children's services department. Louise, are there others?
There are. One of the other cases I originally got permission from Mr Justice Keane to report involved a Herefordshire Council lawyer giving wrong legal advice to the then Director of Children's Services, who in turn gave permission for the life support of a critically ill girl in care to be switched off. He knew her mother was minutes away from the hospital to say goodbye to her daughter, but he didn't wait and she didn't make it in time. That case continues in the family court, and though the mother and the surviving siblings didn't want to speak to me for the programme, I got permission from the judge to publish the fact that just last year, the council itself breached this family's privacy by uploading the deceased girl's name onto its website in a document they hadn't redacted.
What does Herefordshire Council say about all of this?
Well, Herefordshire Council has told us it wants to apologise to children and families affected by its very serious failings. It says urgent change is a top priority, and that it's put in place a 3-year plan to reduce social worker caseloads, to recruit more staff and improve leadership so children and families get the quality of support they need.
Louise Tickle, thank you very much. And you can watch Louise's BBC Panorama, Protecting Our Children, A Balancing Act, at 8 o'clock this evening on BBC One, or, of course, you can catch up on BBC iPlayer. Now, talking about, I suppose, what you watch and what you want to spend your time thinking about, I personally have been hooked on something called Couples Therapy, the docuseries on BBC Two, where you do get to tune into real couples therapy sessions. You know, they've consented, it's there, it's real, and it's addictive, enthralling, and I should also say, maddening at times. I've had quite a few debates about it. I know others can get the same hit from, for instance, Esther Perel's podcasts. Well, wherever you get yours, if you get yours, many of us do find the dynamics of relationships fascinating. My next guest has made a profession out of it, or rather it's found her. So let's find out how this happens. Susanna Absey, a psychoanalytic psychotherapist who's worked in private practice with couples, individuals and parents for over 30 years. She's chair of the British Psychoanalytic Council, and she has a book out, Tell Me the Truth About Love, 13 Tales from the Therapist's Couch. Susanna, good morning.
Morning.
Thank you for being with us. What do you hope to share with people who don't watch or listen to such things, or maybe have never even thought about couples therapy?
Well, I suppose you're partly trying to demystify the process, you know, help people see that the couples who come are ordinary couples with ordinary struggles. That's one of the key things I'm trying to do.
And do you feel comfortable, I suppose, about people tuning into such content, like I mentioned? Because, of course, some say, is it a bit like, you know, what people call food porn, you know, loving watching people make food and then people don't cook themselves? You know, they then don't think, maybe, what's my relationship like? They just love watching others.
Well, it's complex, isn't it, about watching people from a sort of point of view, an ethical point of view. But I think that it's been done carefully in couple therapy. And in my book, the stories that I write about are, you know, fictionalised. There's no real couples in there.
You've pulled together themes.
Themes, yeah. You know, there's so many stories in my mind. It's quite easy to make composite cases up, so which is what I've done. But I think people do get a lot because just like when I'm in the room with a couple, it makes me think about my relationships, my family. It prompts all sorts of new thoughts, which is one of the reasons why we go on doing this work for years on end. Mm. So it does for other people when you read something or you watch something. I'm sure, for instance, Emma, your mind's alive with things that happened to you in the past or relationships you've seen around you or your own relationship.
And also it makes you think, and I know that you talk about this and you explore this, about what is the truth?
Absolutely. I mean, that's why I called it Tell Me the Truth About Love, because there isn't really any truth between couples. You know, we see things that happen to us always happen in the context of our previous experiences, which, you know, distort. So it's like we're seeing through our own lens. And couples, of course, come to see me and often they want the truth. They want me to make a decision about who's telling the truth.
And you don't and can't do that.
No, obviously I can't. I sometimes joke that, you know, perhaps they'd like me to install CCTV in their houses, but it'd be very expensive for me to watch all the films. So, no, because what you're trying to get people curious and you know, well...
And what does that mean in this context, to get people curious?
To get people curious is because people come in with fixed ideas, don't they? They have a belief, an internal belief. This is how it is. You don't care about me. And what you try and do is think about the ordinary things that have happened and then try and make sense of them in terms of, you know, the context, why their partner might be behaving like that. So getting a couple curious in themselves and in each other is the core of the work for me.
Have you had it that people have walked in before and you've thought very quickly they just shouldn't be together?
Very, very, very rarely.
Really?
I mean, you know, you could count that on, you know, on the fingers of one hand.
So the point is, it can work, mm-hmm. and often there is work to do. There's enough. You know, it's not futile.
It's not so much that, in the sense of I don't say, oh, this can work. Sometimes you feel very optimistic. But more that, you know, that isn't my role, actually, to decide whether a couple should be together or not, except in very, very extreme circumstances. It's my role to facilitate them to work out what they want to do.
Tell us about the U-shaped curve when it comes to relationships.
Well, that's about having children and, you know, what many people, unfortunately, well, maybe fortunately for the population, don't realise is the impact of having children on relationship satisfaction. So studies have been done right across the world looking at relationship satisfaction before having children and after, and then as children leave home. And it is a very steep U curve, and you bounce along the bottom of relationship satisfaction until children leave home. And then if you stay the distance, yeah, things tend to get better in terms of how people feel about how happy they are. But of course, this is population studies. You know, there'll be many people out there who, for them, having children is the greatest joy and really has brought them, you know, very close.
Well, speaking of children, you do start the book with Victoria and Rupert, shockingly childish themselves.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you ever just want to bang people's heads together when they're like that? What's their problem?
Well, sometimes you do, but... you know, usually the whole point is you're thinking, well, why are you getting so worked up? What is it that's really driving these feelings that you're so passionately engaged with each other? So, yeah, but of course, sometimes you do, you know, but that if you really felt like that, you wouldn't choose this job.
Do they have light bulb moments, do you think, in front of you? Or is it more they do the work and then they come back? Just if that thing you're saying about trying to get them to come out of where they are and be curious about where the other person is and how they've been perceiving it?
I don't believe in the idea that there is, you know, suddenly a eureka moment. That happens very occasionally. I think it's more about the process of being together in the room with me and exploring something and being with each other And the moments that probably make the biggest difference are the moments where people connect with feelings and share feelings that they haven't known about or haven't wanted to share. And that's poignant and touching. And I try and capture that in the book as well.
When I was looking into why people would put their actual therapy sessions on television, one of the reasons was financial. There's a deal done, as I understand it, for the, a certain number of sessions in that particular BBC programme to be covered. You know, it is expensive and we don't have much provision, I understand, on the NHS.
No, I mean, you know, it's really problematic. I used to be chief exec of Tavistock Relationships and... you know, there always was a little pot of money for relationship support for that organisation and for Relate. And that pot of money now has been shifted towards working with parental conflict and the money has gone away. And I think that's really, really a shame because there are many couples post-pandemic who are in a real state. It's just really emerging now. And there is so little public provision out there. There's a tiny bit of provision in the NHS if you're clinically depressed, but for couple therapy for depression. But that is very, very scarce. It's one of the least, even though it's got the best evidence, you know, it's done really well. It's very rare that people can access it. And we really need to address that for children as well as for the couples themselves.
Well, we also touched a little bit on this. We did I did a special phone in when No Fault Divorce came in England and Wales. And perhaps some of the silver lining of that is not having to find fault and maybe being able to work through things because you haven't had to make things difficult. Yeah. Of course, many of these people who got in touch with me and the programme that day, you know, did not want to be together. That's fine. Sure. But I suppose, you know, I think what you're saying there about the pandemic is very interesting. If we're going to now see people in need after that who might have been okay and might be in a different place now.
Absolutely. And the cost to society is great. You know, for couples to break down, that has all sorts of economic and social consequences, mental health consequences, you know, consequences for their children. Children can recover from divorce, but it's still nevertheless a major disruption in their lives. So you need provision and support around it. And you need to intervene in a way that couples actually can work things through. Post-pandemic, it's an important investment we should be making.
Is it a satisfying job?
Very satisfying, actually, because it's so endlessly interesting. You know, that's, you know, people and human beings are so endlessly diverting and interesting.
And how they see things, their version of the truth. Well, Susanna, thank you very much, Susanna Abzi.
My pleasure.
The book is called Tell Me the Truth About Love. I mean, how many people want to know that? They do. 13 Tales from the Therapist Couch. And a lot of stories put together through these couples to give you a sense of perhaps what goes on in that room and maybe what you would get out of it. And actually, you know, throughout the programme, of course, I've been hearing from you a real range of experiences about some of you being incredibly isolated because of now lockdown working becoming much more normal, working from home, and a lot of you feeling completely liberated by it and hoping it will stay or some form of hybrid. So thank you so much for many of those messages today and, of course, for your company. Back tomorrow at 10. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Thank you so much for your time. Join us again for the next one.
Hi there. I'm just popping up to let you know about another Radio 4 podcast that you may be interested in, especially if, like me, your social media feeds are constantly bombarding you with adverts that are hyping up the latest wonder products, promising you the world. You know the ones, personalised vitamin plans to make you healthier, a pair of sustainable jeans to make you greener, NFTs to earn you millions. I am on a mission to find out the facts behind the fads. I'm Greg Foote, and my BBC Radio 4 podcast Sliced Bread is back to ask if another batch of these wonder products really are the best thing since sliced bread. If you'd like to know about Manuka honey or mosquito repellent or mindfulness apps, or if you've got something you'd like me to investigate for you, just go search for Sliced Bread on BBC Sounds.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.